Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. This is Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science interviews and music. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, a universal flu vaccine, an explanation of why we don't have an eye in the back of our head, and an update on penguins. First, a scientist soundbite.
Certainly for penguins, they're pretty much at their limit at the colony that I've been working on at Punta Tumbo, Argentina, for the last 27 years. They can't go much further and still be able to get back in time to feed their chicks. And it's pretty amazing. They can swim over 100 miles in a day. So they're not just lollygagging around.
You're listening to Dee Boersma, director of the Wildlife Conservation Society's Magellanic Penguin Project, talking about the challenges penguins face. Here's Lindsay Patterson with more.
Thanks, Jorge. Dee Boersma has been called the Jane Goodall of penguins. She's been studying a breeding colony of Magellanic penguins on the Patagonia coast of Argentina for almost 30 years. These penguins don't live on ice. Punta Tumbo, that's the name of the colony, is actually a desert-like environment. I asked Dr. Boersma about what she's observed over the years.
What kind of changes have you seen through your study?
Well, probably one of the most dramatic has been in the last decade, penguins are having to go much further to find food. So these penguins are, during incubation, having to go about an extra 40 miles further than they did a decade ago. It's a very difficult situation, just like it would be for humans. You have less time to spend with your wife or your spouse and less time to spend with your kids. And the penguins are facing that same sort of thing, particularly with this climate change.
You mentioned climate change. How exactly is that impacting the penguins that you're studying?
Well, variation in the ocean world, of course, affects penguins. That's why we think of them as sentinels, telling us something about the ocean environment. And what's happening is that there's lots more variation, which, of course, was predicted. For the penguins, they're having to go further to find their fish because the fish are not coming back as from their migration as soon as they used to. So the penguins are late starting their breeding, and the fish come later, so that means they have to swim further to be able to find them.
So it's kind of a chain effect that's going on through the ocean?
Yes. I mean, that's the thing that's very hard with the natural world. One thing is affected, but lots of other things are affected. I mean, one of the interesting things that people are now finding out is that there are many species, about 40 at least, that sex is dependent on temperature. And with global warming, one of the fish that the penguins depend on, these silversides, their sex is determined by temperature. And when temperatures get warm, it shifts the sex ratio to lots more males than females. And so, of course, if there aren't females, there's not as many eggs that are laid. And so you can get a really dramatic decrease in population. And for penguins, that means less food.
How do you expect the penguins to adapt to these changing conditions? Do you think they'll be able to do it fast enough?
Well, that's the really major concern. We're not so sure that the natural world is going to be able to adapt to many of these changes that are happening so rapidly.
Lindsay, how are the penguins of Punta Tumbo doing this year?
I wish I had good news for you, Jorge, but 2010 hasn't been a very good year for the penguins. Dee Boersma has been down there monitoring how the penguins are faring, and she just sent out an email update saying that she's seen many penguins abandon their mates and their chicks because it's taking them too long to find food. But it looks like they're trying to adapt. Scientists are finding many of the penguins from Punta Tumbo moving to new colonies up north.
I wish these penguin pioneers all the best. Thanks, Lindsay.
You're welcome.
Earth Sky is Lindsay Patterson, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. This is Earth Sky. A new type of flu vaccine is being developed and has entered human trials with support from the U.S. National Institutes of Health and others. It's called a universal flu vaccine, and it's being designed to protect against flu for decades and against future pandemics like H1N1. Dr. Anthony Fauci of the NIH is on the line to explain the universal flu vaccine. Dr. Fauci, welcome.
Good to be here.
Now tell us, what is a universal flu vaccine, and what's most important for the public to know about it?
Well, first of all, everyone knows probably that each year
the flu virus that circulates on a very predictable seasonal basis in the winter in the northern hemisphere, which is our winter, and namely the months that start around end of November, beginning of December through March. And in the southern hemisphere, it's our summer and their winter. But every season, winter season, flu circulates, and it usually changes just a little bit from year to year. We call that a seasonal drift. And by change, we mean it's a little bit different from the previous year. So the vaccine that you got in the previous year will partially but not completely protect you from getting infected, which is the reason why at each year we recommend traditionally that people get the updated vaccine. It almost always changes a little bit, but that requires people getting vaccinated each year. And then in the rare case, as we saw last year, where there isn't just a seasonal small change or drift, there's a major change, or what we call a shift. And that major change leads to the potential of a pandemic in the same way that in 2009, early 2010, we saw the pandemic flu that was called the swine flu, which was a virus that virtually no one, except for older people, had ever experienced in the past, so they were particularly susceptible to getting infected. So when you talk about a universal flu vaccine, you're talking about a vaccine that when you give it to a person, you know, ideally once or twice, or maybe every several years, it would induce a response in the person that would protect them against all of the influenzas, even the ones that change slightly from year to year, or even the ones that dramatically and rarely change very, very much, namely a pandemic. So you call it universal because what it does is it protects you against a wide range of influenza virus. And this, if we accomplish this goal, which we think we're closer to it than we have ever been, this would be a major advance in protecting the population of the United States and hopefully the world against the toll of disease and death caused by influenza, which is substantial each year, even on a seasonal basis.
That was Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. And we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. It's the holiday season and time for the annual Christmas bird count. Lindsay Patterson is back to tell us about it.
This year is the 111th Christmas bird count, happening between December 14th and January 5th. It's the largest and longest running citizen science survey in the world. That means everybody can participate. This year, the Audubon Society, which runs the program, expects tens of thousands of volunteers across the Americas to get outside and count birds for science.
So tens of thousands of people leave their warm homes to go outside to count birds. So how is this information used, Lindsay?
Well, I was also wondering why people would want to leave their eggnog, so I asked Thomas Bancroft. He's the chief scientist of the National Audubon Society.
So there's enough counts going on, almost 2,000 of them, or a little bit more than 2,000 of them, and that we can use those numbers to estimate population trends in the United States for over 300 species of birds. So it gives us a really good scientific tool for monitoring bird populations.
He said that scientists use the data to understand how environmental pressures are affecting birds and assess the overall status of birds, how they're doing in general.
How do people get involved in this?
That's an excellent question. It's pretty easy. Just visit the website, which you can find at birds.audubon.org, to search your region for what the Audubon Society calls a Christmas bird count circle. That's a 15-mile diameter circle that gets split into smaller parts, so 1 to 4 people can cover this area looking for birds. Here's Thomas Bancroft again to explain.
So a person who wants to volunteer needs to find out when the circle is going to be counted in their area, and it's a single day between the 14th of December and the 5th of January. Then they need to contact the local compiler in order to find out what party they can go on and where they can volunteer and help out on it.
Now, I'm a bird newbie, and I'm sure people listening might be also. What if you've never participated in a count before? What do you do then?
Well, one of the nice things about the count is that you can get paired up with more experienced people, people who are birders, people who have just done the count before. And before I go, I want to share what I think is a really interesting piece of history about the Christmas bird count. The first one, back in 1900, was organized as an alternative to a popular holiday tradition at the time, which was a competition to shoot birds on Christmas Day. So Frank Chapman, who was an ornithologist at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, proposed that people count birds instead of killing them. So that hunt is history, and the Christmas bird count continues today.
Thanks, Lindsay.
Thank you.
Earth Sky's Lindsay Patterson. And I'm Jorge Salazar. This is Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. On today's Weird Science, Ryan Britton has a story about an industrial engineer with an innovative design for a prosthetic or artificial arm. She designed an artificial tentacle. Ryan, what's up?
Right. She designed a tentacle like an octopus has. So, you know, we might see people with upper limb amputations sporting tentacles to wrap around objects. You know, we might follow this one under cool science or awesome science because, you know, it's really a pretty stunning invention.
It kind of makes sense. Octopi and squids are very adept at grabbing objects.
Right. Kayleen Cao, she's a graduate of the University of Washington's Industrial Design Project. She participated in what's called the UW Design Show this year, 2010. Her and some of her fellow students explored new ideas for prosthetic arms, ideas that work better than what we have today. So, Kayleen came up with this idea of a tentacle where two motors pull wire through a device to curl a tentacle up and straighten it out again. It's a really simple design that's definitely stylish and could be very reliable.
So why a tentacle versus just a hand?
Well, to give you a little bit of the backstory, Kayleen Cao's advisor, it's a professor by the name of Magnus Fell, had a friend who had a prosthetic arm, and you know, it just didn't work that well. So he challenged Cao and her fellow students to find ways to make a better prosthetic limb. There was some interesting insight that came as a result of their work. What they found was that it doesn't always make sense to try to create, you know, a hand with fingers. What's more important is to look at the interaction between the prosthetic arm and the working biological hand. So Cao designed this lightweight tentacle that opens and closes slowly enough so that the user can have time to put an object in the tentacle's grip.
Pictures of this are really amazing.
That's right. That's right. And to really appreciate the story, you know, I would suggest going and looking at the pictures on the internet. You can find some at cnet.com, but make sure to go to a website at uwdesign2010.com to see the other prosthetic limbs that were created by some of Cao's contemporaries. They're all pretty interesting.
Thanks, Ryan.
You're welcome.
Weird Science with Ryan Britton. We're taking your questions on Facebook. To find us on Facebook, search for Earth Sky. is Earth Sky. Emily Howard joins us now to talk about deforestation, lasers, Google, and how they all came together for Earth's tropical rainforests. Emily, what's happening?
Well, let me begin with deforestation. Deforestation, that's a big deal when it comes to discussing climate change because trees store carbon. And when forests are cut down, that carbon goes into the atmosphere as CO2, which is a greenhouse gas that's linked to global warming. I spoke with Dr. Greg Asner of the Carnegie Institution for Science in Stanford, and he recently surveyed the Amazon rainforest in southern Peru, an area about the size of Switzerland, to understand and create geographical maps of how much carbon is present in the trees there.
If you were to take all of the carbon that's stored in all tropical forests and you were to burn it all up, you would emit into the atmosphere about 5 times the amount of carbon dioxide that's already in the atmosphere. So it's a huge amount of carbon sitting in these tropical regions that, in terms of climate change, we don't want that carbon released into the atmosphere.
Dr. Asner says you can tell how much carbon a forest holds based on the size, height, and density of its trees, which brings me to lasers. In order to chart carbon levels in forests, Dr. Asner uses data gathered on the ground, as well as data gathered by lasers mounted on airplanes.
The core technology in the study involves LIDAR, which stands for light detection and ranging. We have a particular kind of LIDAR that we fly on an airplane that fires out of the bottom of the airplane and sweeps across the forest, measuring not only the height of the trees, but the three-dimensional structure as you pass down through the tree canopy and down to the forest floor. With that technology, we're able to image the forest in 3D, kind of like a CAT scan.
Technology such as LIDAR is an important way to gather information about forest density because it's hard to gauge how many trees are in a patch of rainforest when you look at it from above. Now, this is a catch that's often exploited by illegal loggers. People can actually go into an area and do some logging and go completely unnoticed if they leave enough trees there to create a canopy shield. And this brings me to Google. Dr. Asner recently teamed up with Google to create Earth Engine, and this is a place on the internet that brings together all of this satellite data and maps about the Earth's natural resources and how they've changed over time. And it's expected that this can be a useful tool in making policy decisions as well as monitoring illegal activities such as deforestation.
Space lasers to save forests, not science fiction.
Nope, it is not. This is science fact. And who knew that when humanity would finally get lasers into the jungle, it would be in the spirit of conservation.
Thanks, Emily.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Emily Howard. And we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. This is Earth Sky. I'm Jorge Salazar. In late 2010, NASA announced plans to develop a mission to study the atmosphere of the planet Mars. It's called MAVEN, short for the Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution Mission, and it's scheduled to launch in 2013. On the line now is MAVEN's principal investigator, Bruce Jacoski. Dr. Jacoski, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Now, what is MAVEN, the Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution Mission?
Our mission is designed to explore the upper atmosphere of Mars. What we're trying to do is to look at how gases escape from the atmosphere to space. What we want to do is understand how the climate has changed, how the atmosphere has changed over time. And we think the evidence points to loss out the top of the atmosphere as having been a very important process in that history of climate. We're going to be the first mission to fully explore the upper atmosphere. And our goal is to learn what happened to the atmosphere. Where did the atmosphere go? Where did the water go?
Would you mind explaining a little bit about how that's done?
In this case, we already know that the atmosphere has changed over time. All of the missions that we've been running, something like a dozen or more over the past 25 or 30 years, have told us that water has been present on Mars, that early Mars, 3.5 to 4.5 billion years ago, had liquid water and probably that the water was stable, yet today's atmosphere is cold and dry. So we know that things have changed. What we want to do is understand why they've changed. The biggest difference is that we think that early Mars had a thick CO2-rich greenhouse atmosphere that provided warming. And the big question has been, where did the CO2 go? Where did the water go? It either went down into the crust or up into space. So our goal is to look at the amount of water, of CO2, that has been lost to space. You've asked a really good question about how we can extrapolate backwards in time. And we've devised three different approaches to doing that. The first is that we're looking at a time in the solar cycle when the energetic drivers of the atmosphere are changing. The ultraviolet energy that drives the chemistry and that drives escape and the solar wind are changing significantly at the time we're going to be measuring. So we'll be able to see the response of the atmosphere directly to those changes in the solar wind and in the sun. That's the first approach. We know what the sun was like in the past from studying other stars, so that immediately allows us to extrapolate backwards in time. The second approach is to understand the processes responsible for determining, for controlling the structure of the upper atmosphere and for driving escape. And then we know how those processes behaved in the past because we understand their response. And then finally, you brought up the point about looking in ice cores at the Earth. One of the things we look at on the Earth are isotopes. We're doing the same thing on Mars. We're going to measure the ratio of oxygen 18 to 16, of carbon 13 to 12, and so on. And in this case, the escape, each of those ratios is sensitive to the escape to space. The lighter isotope is lost more readily. So by measuring that ratio, we can directly determine how much gas has been lost over time. Together, these give us a very robust determination of what's happened to the atmosphere.
That was planetary scientist Bruce Chekosky. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science.
That's our show. Thanks for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers, Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, Monahans, The Black and White Years, Sleep Good, The Story of, Built by Snow. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next stage. There are so many artists, too much art, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next stage.